Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time, MASH, which aired on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP tent are two special guests, the host of the MASH Matters podcast, Jeff Maxwell and Ryan Patrick. Hi, guys.
Hey,
we're here. Us too. The both of the guys.
Hey. I am so excited to have you both on the show. This is like that episode of MASH where Hawkeye and Margaret went to the 855th. And then it's like that episode. It could be like that. So
Wait. Does that mean that Roy Dupree is hosting MASH Matters right now as we speak? Is that?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, okay.
Exactly.
All right.
You could do worse than George Goober Lindsay.
That's true.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, of course.
Gosh,
everybody...
I wish I knew what you guys were talking about. That's okay.
Well, Jeff, there was a show on CBS called MASH, which was set during the Korean War. It was actually about the Vietnam War, but it was set during the Korean War. It ran for 11 seasons. It was very popular.
Oh, good. Yeah. I've heard it was a cute little show. All right.
You should watch it.
I'm gonna look at some episodes. Yes, I will.
It's available in multiple platforms. So, okay, of course, last year, the boys were nice enough to have me as a guest on their show. And so they're being generous enough to return the favor here by joining me to talk about season 4, episode 12, Soldier of the Month, an episode of which Igor gets a lot to do. Is very exciting. Mm-hmm. The original air date was November 28th, 1975. It was written by Linda Bloodworth and directed by Gene Reynolds. Now, of course, normally this would be where I ask my new guests how they became fans of MASH, but we all know that because you guys host a MASH podcast. Jeff, I imagine you became a fan of the show once you, got hired to be in it. I imagine that was your moment where you became a fan of the show.
Yes, I became a fan of the paycheck. Quickly, very, very quickly.
I'm sure. So I will ask you one thing about this particular season of MASH, and you can answer this as diplomatically or non-diplomatically as you choose.
I'm nervous. I'm really getting nervous.
I've been saying every episode, and I've said this for a long time, that I think not only is season 4 of MASH the best season of MASH in terms of just how consistently it was with its quality. To me, every episode is virtually a classic. But I also would say that season 4 of MASH is the best season of television, period. No other show has ever matched this level of balance of comedy, drama, innovation, working in new characters, but still retaining the thing about MASH that made it so good in the first three seasons. So I'm not going to ask you to go that far, but I do want to ask each one of you, what's your opinion generally of this era of MASH, where you had BJ and Colonel Potter, but also still with Frank? It was kind of that the holdover between the first three seasons of the show and then the later season. So, Ryan, I'll start, since you're nervous, Jeff. Ryan, we'll start with you. What's your general opinion of this era of MASH?
I agree with you that this is probably one of the best seasons of the show. It's really firing on all cylinders at this point. You have the expert way, the masterful way that they were able to transition away from Trapper and Henry into BJ and Potter, and they really did it seamlessly. For a show of this magnitude to be able to do that and still continue and never have a feeling like there's a loss of quality. In fact, I feel like the show even got better. Mm-hmm. That's not a knock, of course, to McLean Stevenson or to Wayne Rogers, because they were exceptional in those roles. I just think at this point, everything's firing. And the addition of Potter brought a new dynamic to the show. There's a different feel to the show, a different energy to the show. And because of that, I think they just keep going up, up, and up, and up. So, yeah, I would agree that this is the beginning of something really great for MASH. The middle seasons are really some of my favorite seasons, to be honest with you. When we see Potter come in and we see the introduction of BJ, and then we see Frank leave and we see the introduction of Charles, that era is some of my favorite episodes are in the next two, three seasons.
Absolutely. Jeff?
What Ryan said.
Okay. This is what the whole episode is going to be like. Ryan's going to comment on the scene, and then Jeff is going to say
pretty much. Right, pretty much. No, I'll throw in a little 2 cents. I agree with everything Ryan said. Yes, he absolutely knows what he's talking about, and that's absolutely true. And I think because every television show or everything that any of us do, you tend to get better at it usually. And so MASH is no different. It was a group of people who were a bunch of actors trying to get work in Hollywood and make a living and support their families and all that kind of stuff. And so when they caught the tail of the tiger and they knew what they had, I think everybody wanted it to get better and wanted to do the best work they could possibly do. And as it evolved over the first 2 or 3 years, it did change. There were things that they grew into the roles. They grew into the characters. The writers grew into the roles. And so in that, I think you're right, Ryan, in terms of the fourth year, whoever said that, Ryan or Rob, whoever said that is really right. The fourth year really did kind of take off because everybody went, I get it. You know, the characters they got what they were doing. They got the rhythm. They got where they were going. They got their vision and they had it. And bringing on those two actors Mike Farrell was a terrific actor. And my gosh, you can't get better than Harry Morgan.
Oh,
you
just man. Yeah.
You just cannot. And so when you bring a guy like that into a set, it raises the level of interest and focus because everybody wants to be as good as he is. And so it just raised the level of everybody's effort and desire to make it all right. So, yeah, I think that really did supercharge it in season 4.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
we also know in retrospect, you know, we viewers know now that this is Larry Gelbart's last season with the show. And Larry was, of course, a legend. And when it comes to writing, nobody did it better. Nobody was a better writer than Larry Gelbart. And to know that all the shows had his fingerprints still on it, whether he wrote the show himself or he was doing rewrites or he had influence on the writers of these episodes, he still was a part of it at this point. And so when you have a show that is firing on all cylinders and you have Larry Gelbart, how could it not be the best season of television?
Yeah.
One of the things I keep saying throughout the season is that not only was the show great for its big swings, like, the Welcome to Korea or Quo Vadis, Captain Chandler, or The Interview, where they were really trying to bust the form of the sitcom. Mm-hmm. Not only are those good, but they were good at the small ones. I mean, the sort of lower gear episodes, kind of like this one or Dear Peggy, ones where that are just more day in the life and funny situation. They're really, really good. Yeah. It would be one thing to say, well, we really busted the form and those were really good. Yeah, there were some lesser ones, but man, those great ones are really great. No, even the sort of lower gear ones are really great.
Yes.
And that is a consistency that is virtually unheard of in television. And so that's why I keep saying this season is just so ridiculously good. Now, Jeff, one other thing I want to ask before we get into the synopsis, like from your perspective, was it a different set when you would get there with the infusion of these new people? Was it just kind of a different energy? I mean, I guess it would have to be because they're different people. Did you notice that when you were there? Was there a different sort of synergy going on with Mike Farrell and Harry Morgan being there as opposed to Wayne and McClane?
I think there was a little bit of a change in the level of excitement. I don't want to, that people weren't leaping around and acting like kangaroos or anything, but they were, it just forces you to put yourself on your game a little bit more. And you just can't help it. There's new people. There's a new, there's just new stuff floating around. And so you're on your game, you're wired up, you're energized, you're looking around, you're seeing what's new. People were trying to get used to each other. So there's a level of excitement there, and it just raises everybody up. And that's – I kind of noticed that. There was a heightened level of awareness and excitement. It was a new journey and a new cast. So certainly everybody was, looking forward to it and wanted to do their best. So, yeah.
Yeah, I've never been on a set. I've never been any in that situation at all. But I've said on other podcasts I've done that, like, if I had ever been on a set, and maybe this is not the way you're supposed to behave, so I don't know. But to me, it's like if I had been in something with someone that had, like, a Harry Morgan, who had this legendary career, I think I would just be peppering them with questions about that. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, this is a guy that was in High Noon. He was in Inherit the Wind. He was in the Oxbow Incident.
Yes.
I would just be like, Harry, just tell me stories about working with Gary Cooper. I mean, all I would want to talk to. I wouldn't go back to my trailer. I'd be like, tell me Inherit the Wind stories, Harry.
I agree. Yeah, tell me about Spencer Tracy. What was that? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Frederick March. Was that really cool in that courtroom?
Yeah.
Yeah, I really regret that I didn't do that. I was an idiot sometimes back then, and I didn't realize exactly what I had.
Yeah.
You kind of don't. You're just in it.
Yeah.
Realize it. And I knew who he was, but it just didn't hit me. And had it, I would have been doing the same thing you just suggested. I would, Harry, you told me, Gary Cooper, everybody. I couldn't help it. So I guess I'm glad that I didn't, because I would probably have been fired.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. I'm imagining
this guy out of here. Would you please?
Yeah. I'm trying to learn my scenes, Jeff. Yeah. That's my terrible Harry Morgan impression. So. But okay. Well, excellent. So let's talk about this episode. It's Soldier of the Month. So he said it starts off with Colonel Potter. He's holding a surgical staff meeting in the mess tent, giving doctors the latest news on Korean hemorrhagic fever, which some soldiers in post-op are suffering from. There's also a new directive. In a way to boost morale, there will be a Soldier of the Month contest where the top-rated enlisted man from each camp will win a trip to Tokyo, causing Radar, Klinger, and others to try and curry favor from the judge, Major Burns. But Frank can't make the decision because he comes down with the fever as well. He ends up bedridden and delirious, convinced he's going to die. Hawkeye and BJ fill in and hold a quiz for Radar, Klinger, Zale, and Igor to see who knows the most about U.S. history. Zale doesn't get a single question correct. Igor seems a bit checked out. And Klinger, having cheated by writing the answers all over his body, gets caught. The winner ends up being Radar, who actually seemed to prepare for the quiz. Frank, sure he's going to die, asks Father Mulcahy to write a will for him. And all his chicanery and dishonesty is revealed. Prescription kickbacks, doctored books that hide his real income from the government, even another affair he's having back home. The final straw for Margaret, overhearing all of this, is when Frank tearfully leaves her all of his clothes. Eventually, Frank recovers thanks to fine doctoring by Hawkeye and BJ. Margaret takes him to the latrine for the first time since getting sick, and when he emerges feeling normal, Margaret pays him back for the slight by slapping him across the face. Next time, leave your clothes to someone your own size. A few days later, Radar comes back from Tokyo, totally drunk and in custody from the MPs for his disorderly conduct. His stumbling, slurring behavior in front of Colonel Potter causes Hawkeye and BJ to fall over in hysterics. So, all right, that is Soldier of the Month. Before I get into the individual scenes, I'm going to ask
you. Well, it was good talking to you.
thanks, everybody.
Wonderful show. Wonderful show. Thank you.
I can record 10 of these in a day, Jeff. It's very, very efficient. Let's start about, when you were how far ahead were you given notice that, hey, Igor is going to play, you're going to be involved in this one, and you're going to get, like, you're playing a big part in this one. How far ahead did you learn that kind of stuff so you could make plans?
About 30 minutes. Is Jeff around? Yeah, I think he's over there. Oh, tell him he's going to be in this one, okay?
Okay.
No, I got the script when everybody else got the script. Script folks printed the script. First the writers wrote it, and then the script people printed it, and then it was up to the producers to distribute the strips, the scripts, to all of the people who were in the show, and I was one of them. So everybody that was in that episode got the script pretty much at the same time. They just, passed them around.
Okay.
So how long? Probably a couple of days, something like that. A couple of days.
You must have been thrilled then when you got this, right? Because all of a sudden you're like, wow, look at this. I'm in this huge scene and I get to be really funny in typical Igor style.
I did. Yeah. No, it was very exciting. I was excited every day they let me walk on that set. Marina can really come in here? Yeah. Okay. So I was a very happy guy. It was very exciting to be there and a very exciting thing to see my name, you know, Private Igor. I would very quickly look at the script and it was, if I saw Igor, I was, yippee! Something to do Tuesday. That's great.
And I do find it, in the opening scene where we see Klinger is the one dispensing the food. And that's always, every time you have Klinger doing the food, it's because obviously they're going to pay that off in a minute. The Klinger is going to be needed for some reason. Because normally, of course, that would have been Igor.
Yeah,
but if anytime it's Klinger, it's because we need to introduce Klinger into the scene for some reason. And so there's this nice little back and forth in the opening where we, you know, Radar and a recurring motif with him is that he eats a ton of food, and Klinger, they talk about the quality of the food, and there's a reference to The Shadow, the old time radio series, of course. So that's a fun little detail. I do love this opening scene because it's the meeting with all the doctors, and they're talking about the Korean hemorrhagic fever, and it requires Klinger, again, to get him into the scene, to come by, and he's got like a pitcher of water or coffee. And I love that, like, there are moments where the mess tent has like a waiter just to come
by. Well, you know, very interesting you said that, because I watched it and I thought, you know, that's weird, because in the mess tent, nobody would walk around pouring coffee to anybody. Anybody would say, can you give me a cup of coffee? No, get it yourself. You know, nobody would have been doing that. So it was an odd thing. And even in the background, I saw somebody pouring coffee to the tables way in the back. So I thought, what? That's a weird thing to have done. That's just odd, you know, attitude. Well, let's have him walk around pouring coffee.
Right.
It was so out of, you know, character for everybody. It kind of threw me for a minute.
Yeah. I mean, there's no justifiable reason to have Klinger in this scene, because it's a scene with the doctors. And of course, Radar's there to take notes. So it's like, okay, we got to find a way to work Klinger into the scene. Oh, okay. Let's have him act like he's bussing these tables.
Yeah. I expected to, you know, him to lay a check down on the table.
Right,
you know, thank you very much for coming.
I hope he got a good tip. Yeah.
Did you guys like to see something from the dessert cart? Like, okay. All right. All right.
Exactly.
Hey, you mentioned The Shadow, and to my knowledge, this is the second reference to The Shadow in the show, because back in Adam's Ribs,
that's right,
Hawkeye uses the name Cranston Lamont as his fake reporter name.
One of my favorite
when he's talking
jokes
on the phone. Yeah, and of course, Lamont Cranston was the name of the Shadow. So I think that this, and maybe I'm wrong, but are these the only two references to The Shadow in the series? I can't remember if there were any others.
I can't think of another one. I mean, we might discover it as I go on, but these are the only two that are really, and they even do the laugh, like, you know,
I just remembered. There is another reference to The Shadow when they're watching Radar's home movies, and they're talking about the family going in to listen to the radio, and spout off a couple of different shows, and The Shadow is one of them.
That's right. Okay.
And
that's
three references. Three.
And that's this season too. So we're going to watch. Okay. That's true.
I think you guys get to go to Tokyo. This is.
I will say I was quite proud of the fact, we'll get to that scene in a moment, but I was quite proud that all the questions that Hawkeye asks, I knew all the answers. I was very happy about that. Right? I know the capital of Cleveland and everything. I'm really on top of all this stuff. So he said in this opening scene with the doctors where they're talking about the Korean hemorrhagic fever and talking about all the rats on the base. And, you know, I know that it's meant to be funny, but I have to say, like, I have always been horrified at the idea that, like, the 477th was riddled with rats.
Yeah.
I just find that really, like, it's all done as a jest. There was a previous episode where Hawkeye talks about, he even talks about this. He says, has anybody seen any rats? He says, just the couple building building something on my shoebox or whatever it is. There's one in a Winchester episode where we see him pull a rat carcass out from under a bed. And I don't know. I mean, I guess if I was assigned here, I wouldn't have any choice, but just the idea that you're living somewhere where rats are regularly showing up just makes me, it just horrifies me. Yeah.
Well, you're not coming over to my house for dinner.
All right.
Done.
Well, speaking of controlling the rats, why? And I know that this has been a topic that's been broached on this podcast many times. But why on earth are they putting an officer in charge of controlling the rats on the base? Even more so, a doctor.
Yeah, don't they have enough to do? Doesn't
are the enlisted men too busy to handle, you know, rat control in the 477th?
Yeah, oh my that seems like an Igor job, to be honest with you.
Yeah, really. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
I mean, he's not working in the mess tent this episode.
Yeah, exactly.
So
right.
What the heck is he doing?
I love in that scene that that Potter asks for volunteers, and Hawkeye stands up, presumably volunteering, and then of course hands it over to Burns. And Burns is such a ninny, and he's so happy to just be like part of the gang that he takes it on, even though it's clearly an insult. I mean, you know, Hawkeye's dumping this in his lap, and Frank's just like, oh, okay. And then he has the great line about where he's like, "I'm very busy right now. I'm also in control of rumor. I'm also rumor officer," which BJ says, "I've heard that," which is a great. But like, I love the idea of the rumor control. Like, what is that?
Yeah.
What is that supposed to be at the fourth episode?
Well, he's the man for the job. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, you know, fantastic. And of course, Margaret is already angling for a promotion. Mm-hmm. She says, "Well, this will get Major Burns a promotion." Like, really? Taking control of the rats at the 4th, 7th is what, going to get you colonel? Like, what is that about?
You know, there was a whole big thing about that there were a lot of rats on stage 9. And there were some. I mean, I didn't see a lot of them, but you'd occasionally see something crawling around, and there were rats. So I don't know whether that, and I'm without doubt there were rats, you know, in the 4077. If it was really in Korea, there would have been rats. But, you know, that might have been something that was on the minds of the writers, because there was always talk about rats.
Lord. Oh, my God. Yeah. The movies and TV are so glamorous. So,
oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah.
My goodness.
Sure you want to be in show business, kids?
Yeah. Oh, man. Now, we're speaking of like the delivering of the coffee. There's a great little detail in here, in that I've been tracking as we're going through the sort of evolution of the relationship between Hawkeye and BJ. In a previous episode, I mentioned that Hawkeye refers to Peg as your wife. Because he doesn't know her yet. He's still referring to BJ's wife as your wife, as opposed to saying Peg. Later on, he would become much more comfortable and just refer to her. And Peg is, that's her name. But there's a moment here where BJ gets up, and you see he's going up to get more coffee. And he reaches down and grabs Hawkeye's coffee cup, who hands it up to him. And there's no dialogue. They just do it silent. And I love that. It's a tiny little thing, but I love that moment. That BJ and Hawkeye are getting to know each other, and they're already very close friends, and that, like, you would do with your friend or you would do for your spouse. You've already known that they want more coffee, so you get it for them. And I love that they don't bother to have any sort of dialogue about that. It's just a nice offhand little thing. I think that's a great little detail that BJ's getting more and more familiar with this guy, his bunkmate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think it's good too, because, you know, maybe that was an intentional, you know, the little nuances like that, maybe those were intentional to show that, you know, hey, Trapper's gone. Here's BJ. He's one of us. He's, you know, we're not, you know, you should feel comfortable with him, because we, as these characters, also are feeling very comfortable with him. It's almost like an endorsement of BJ.
Yep.
Yeah. So after that scene, then we have the scene in post-op where they start talking about the hemorrhagic fever. And we've already started – Gene Reynolds, the director, has already started to layer in the details where they are like – they look at this one soldier and they're like, well, who ordered all this water? And you cut to Frank, and we see that Frank is drinking a glass of water, which is a tip-off that he's got the fever. And we see that he's sweating on his undershirt. He's sweating way more than he normally would. And this is another thing I always love mentioning. I'm always just fascinated about TV production. Is when they cut to Frank drinking the water, we see the fourth wall of the post-op, which we, you know, and of course that's extra work. Now, Jeff, I don't know if you can speak to this, but like when they did that, I mean, was like the fourth wall of any given set like off to the side somewhere? And when they needed it, they just kind of wheel it in? I mean, that seems like it's a lot of extra work when you could have just had Frank kind of wander into the frame with a glass of water. But no, they took the time to show the fourth wall of the post-op.
Can we quote you on that?
Yeah. Okay, forgive me. Let me back up for a second. I know you said that very enthusiastically. Which wall are we talking? Which fourth wall? I'm not
the,
which
basically
which scene?
Yeah. As we're looking at post-op and all the heads of the patients are right in front of us, and then there's the hall, there's the end of the beds, and then the hall, and then, like, you know, the hallway, and then the other side of post-op, when they say, who ordered this water? It's a cut to Burns, and he's drinking a glass of water. And by the way they're looking at him, it's clearly meant to be the wall that the table with the glass of water is up against is the wall that would be there if it was a real building. But, of course, that wall's not there because that's how we're watching it. But
okay, was it just him in that shot?
Yes, it's just
– okay. Well, that could be any wall anywhere then.
Okay. Oh, not necessarily a wall that you
right.
wheeled in.
They could – if there was a wall – ordinarily, if there was a wall with a, you know, a bed or something sitting there, they could just move that out of the way and say, here's the square. We have to shoot the guy in. Here's the wall. And they just shoot it like that.
Gotcha. Okay. I didn't even realize that. That they had
so his close-up and his scene would have been, you know, they just put him up against the wall and say, okay, talk.
Gotcha.
And the actors would be on their side. So that he wasn't necessarily standing in the place that you saw in that master shot.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah. All right. That makes – because once in a while, MASH will show the fourth wall of any given set. And I always appreciate that it's an extra effort to give it some verisimilitude. They're like, well, these are real buildings with four walls. Obviously they're faking it, but it, again, I think it's a nice extra bit of detail.
Yeah. As I recall, and I could be totally off, but as I recall, if you're going to do that, you're going to use the wall that's there and you're going to make it look like it's a different wall.
Gotcha. Okay.
It's just a lot less time and money to do that than it is to get another wall.
Right.
Cause you're right. The walls did not wheel in and out. So that's, it would have been a whole big predicament.
Gotcha. Okay. Boy, Frank is one bad doctor because he doesn't even know that one of his patients is in shock.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a pretty bad doctor.
Well, and we have to have something like that happen so that we have the exposition
right.
to tell what this fever is. There's a
right.
lot of exposition in this, you know, explaining what this is. But I still think that Linda Bloodworth Thomason did a really good job of not just making it a lecture. You know,
mm-hmm.
when BJ, you know, in the previous scene, when BJ stands up to say, may I add something to this conversation? I was afraid that he was going to then give the entire lecture of what the fever was at that
PowerPoint presentation.
Exactly. Yeah. Let me just remind everybody what they already know, but here it is, you know. Thankfully he didn't. She did a good job of spreading that explanation over several scenes, so that you got it in pieces, rather than all in one big chunk.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they work in this is and this is the moment for Father Mulcahy to get something to do where
mm-hmm.
they talk about that he's in Tokyo
yes.
and he's researching the hemorrhagic fever. And then that leads to the scene, which is right immediately following where Hawkeye and BJ are in Mulcahy's tent. And he gives them the details about the Korean hemorrhagic fever. And again, mm-hmm. it's a great way to work in all the characters. So, very smooth writing by Linda Bloodworth.
Yeah, Linda Bloodworth. Was that your
yeah.
what was it your your that writer's name? Was that your pen name?
Exactly. How do you think Igor got a part in that show?
A little note about Linda Bloodworth, who later would become Linda Bloodworth Thomason. She was actually from my neck of the woods. She grew up in a town called Poplar Bluff, Missouri, which is about two and a half hours away from where I live. That's in the boot heel of Missouri, and I live down in the southern tip of Illinois. But she would go on to create Designing Women
sure.
and also Evening Shade.
Yep.
And actually, the character of Charlene from Designing Women, that character was also from Poplar Bluff, Missouri. So in our area, it was like, oh, hey, we know where that is. It's really cool. So it was always nice when you got some kind of reference from home in a big TV show.
Cool. That's I didn't know any of that. I mean, I knew she created those shows, but I didn't know that she had that other stuff. You're bringing stuff from her hometown into her work. Yeah, she had it. Yeah. Went on to a very long career. This is their. Her fourth of five MASHes that she would write. Of course, she would go on to work on in season five, The Nurses, a classic episode. Mm, so, I mean, all her episodes are very, very good. So,
yeah.
I mean, she's the previous ones, I believe, in the season three, she co-wrote with Mary Kay Place. But this one, she's sole credited. And it's a great episode. And as you said, she works in the detail about the Korean hemorrhagic fever, weaves it in pretty well.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I do have a little comment about Loretta Swit and you know, Hot Lips and what's this guy's name?
Frank.
Frank. When she, we can, unless you want to wait until we get to that scene, because I have a comment about that.
And, okay.
And then the blood work. Okay.
Okay. All right. Absolutely. Yeah. When we get to it, we'll talk about that. Yeah. So, okay. So after that scene with Father Mulcahy, we have a scene in the CO's office where, we talk about that the test is coming in and, the answers arrive and Potter's like, oh, we got to put them in the safe. And how does he open the safe? Well, it's the combination of the safe is, Mrs. Potter's measurements, which are 42, 36, 42. And I have no frame of reference for what that is. So I had to look that up. Mrs. Potter would be pretty curvy at that. Those measurements. Yeah. That is like a Tex Avery cartoon kind of anatomy of like the eyes bugging out or something like that. Like, wow. I didn't, Mrs. Potter's really, woohoo.
Yeah.
So he opens the safe and he puts the answers in there and he pulls out a bottle of booze, which mm-hmm. is fun. And like, obviously, because he's got a separate liquor cabinet, but obviously yeah. whatever that bottle is must be really good stuff.
That's the good stuff.
That's the good stuff. And he talks to Radar about the test and they're getting into how much history is there? Where he's like, how long between Adam and Eve and the Indians showing up? Well, there's a lot to cover there, Radar. So,
yeah.
And then we back in the swamp and we see that Klinger, of course, in his full dress uniform is trying to curry favor with Frank. And they're doing it by setting rat traps under the bed. And we see Frank has got this absurd outfit where he's carrying a pillow around and gloves. And they talk about that the temptation for the rats is this cake, and Klinger takes a whiff and says, this is really barf making. You think the rats are going to go for it? And of course, that is Mrs. Burns's fruitcake, which he says, well, you should know because you are one yourself. And I I love all scenes of MASH, but I really do enjoy Larry Linville with Jamie Farr because they are just so, they're oil and water. I mean, yeah. Their characters are just so opposite, and poor Klinger can't reveal to Burns how much he holds him in contempt. Mm-hmm. But it's fun to watch Klinger sort of just have to skate right under the surface of what's acceptable to say. Cause he assumes Burns is an idiot, which yeah. he is. But to me, it's almost like they're almost like a wonderful comedy team, unofficially, because they just are so in contrast to one another.
Yeah, talk about an odd couple, right? I mean, yeah. it's Felix and Oscar. I love too the speech that Klinger gives to Frank explaining why he should be Soldier of the Month yeah. and explaining that he can't be crazy to be Soldier of the Month. So he's not crazy unless he doesn't get it, but then he is crazy. And the phrase he uses, Nutsy Fagin, and mm-hmm. I kind of did a little deep dive on that because I knew the character of Fagin was from Oliver Twist and the musical Oliver, but I didn't know if there was something behind that. And there's not a lot out there about this phrase, except apparently there was a popular song in the 20s by that name. There's a commercial on YouTube for something called Nutsy Fagin Spicy Coated Peanuts.
Wow.
And it's a bizarre commercial. You can, you know, go to YouTube and look for it. It's kind of a weird commercial. And then, you know, there was this news group that, Larry Gelbart and our friend here, Jeff Maxwell, would post on back in the early days of the internet, the alt.tv MASH news group. And somebody asked about that. And actually, you can still access that news group through Google. And Larry Gelbart would post answers to questions. And he actually explained that Nutsy Fagin was, in his youth, a reference to someone who had a screw loose who wasn't all there. So that was, you know, that was just his, that was his definition. But I never knew if there was more to that phrase. So there is, but there isn't. There's just not a lot out there about that slogan.
I love
it. I feel like ordering those nuts. That sounded really good.
You really got to love Klinger's just complete Rube Goldberg idea of I'm nuts, but then unless this happens, then yes. I'm not nuts. But then if it doesn't happen, then I'm back to being like, Yeah. It, you know, it's just it's like a choose your
it's like a choose your own adventure book.
Yeah, it's, it really is. You're like, boy, he really put a lot of thought behind this. Of just this scenario, all this to win a couple days in Tokyo.
I know.
I guess so. So then BJ and Hawkeye show up in the tent. We hear a snap, and we see that the rat trap, or at least we hear that the rat trap, we don't actually see it, has cracked down on Klinger's knuckles, which to me is just makes me wince because I just know that those things are meant to really hurt. And so they could break your knuckles. And that just drives Klinger, you know, contest or no contest, I'm not pushing any more of your traps. And again, another great detail that I love that this show takes the time to do. And I'm always curious as to whether this is an actor thing or a writer thing. But while we are looking, the, you know, the front of the scene is Hawkeye and Burns talking about this trap. And that's what we're supposed to pay attention to because they're the ones having dialogue. But in the background, we see BJ examining Klinger's fingers because he's a good doctor. Yeah. You know, it's like he cares. He cares that Klinger might have broken knuckles. And I just love that detail that it's BJ and Hawkeye are good doctors. I mean, we already knew that already, but it's just another great little detail. That's something that you really don't notice if you're paying attention to the dialogue being spoken. That BJ takes a moment to examine someone in pain. It's like, I just, it's, this is why I love these characters so much.
It's a brief moment. It's a very fast examination. Yeah. So, but to nobody's surprise, Klinger may have been over-exaggerating a bit as
well. A bit. So after that, that leads to one of my favorite MASH props of all time, which is this rat trap. Which is the most insane, like, I don't even know how it works because it presumably has electric power. And yet, what is it hooked up to? And Gene Reynolds really sells it by putting the camera in the rat trap.
So we're looking at our actors. That was great.
And it's this thing about where there's a mirror and the rat sees himself. And then a little thing comes down and it taps the rat. And the rat turns around to see who wants him, which is like, what are we talking about? And then that, of course, triggers these nails to come down. Again, great sound effect by this thunk sound effect. And it's supposed to hit the rat in the head, which will knock it out. And, of course, you know, Hawkeye's reaction is, that's positively brilliant, Frank. After you're done, all these rats are going to need to be fitted for glasses. It's just like, how did he build this? Like,
More importantly, why? Why did he build this? They've got perfectly good rat traps. They work. Ask Klinger. He knows. They work.
Yeah.
Why did you have to go and build this thing? And it looks really well. I mean, it's like the engineers were called in to build this thing. It's really well built. And I can't believe that Frank actually built that thing.
How would he know how to build? This thing, like, I would imagine if this thing on the open market would probably cost you about $500. So the amount of complexity involved. I mean, my God. And, you know, I almost don't want to know the answer to this because if it's not what I want it to be, I'm going to be sad. I like to think that all the MASH props, the ones that weren't, like, sent to the Smithsonian, we know that, like, the swamp was sent to the Smithsonian. But all these minor props are still somewhere. They were given to somebody. And so somebody, some MASH person or the wife or the husband or the cousin of somebody on Mac has this rat trap that it wasn't just thrown away. I like to think that because somebody on the staff had to make this thing. And I know that studios don't store things anymore because they just, you know, they run out of room, but I don't know all the MASH props. I hope they're still around somewhere.
They're in your attic, aren't they, Jeff?
I have all of it right here.
You took them all on the last day? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Jeff's like, they're buried in a time capsule. Why don't I just take all the props with me? Sure.
And you know, the rat trap thing he built really works. I actually – problem is I caught a cat with it. That was –
oh, no.
Yeah, the cat. But the cat got away. It was all right. It didn't work that well, so the cat was fine, but it did go in the box.
And the cat looks adorable in glasses, too.
Yeah, wonderful. So,
He's got little radar glasses. So
exactly. Sure. Yeah.
Absolutely. So
we've got the contact lenses, actually, which is really good for a cat.
You know what? From my experience, you can tap a cat on the back. It's not going to turn around to see who wants him. The cat just doesn't
care. That's true.
So, and that leads to Frank, of course, being revealed that he's got the fever because he passes out and collapses with the rat trap in his lap. And Hawkeye and BJ have this eye roll of like, okay, great. And that's our act break.
Yes, but did you catch that when Frank passes out, he hits his head?
Yeah,
yes. Like something, yes. Something hard as it's going back. And I've never known if that was an accident or if it was intentional. You know, if maybe he just sat in a different spot a little bit further back. So when he went back, his head just happened to hit the ledge there by Hawkeye's cot. And to his credit, he didn't break, and neither did Alan or Mike. I mean, mm-hmm. they kept going, but it's always amazed me that Larry hits his head on the way down, and it hits hard.
Yeah. It's a great pratfall, great pratfall. Cause obviously, you know, when you know you're going to fall, you're going to cushion your blow a little. It's just human nature. Mm-hmm. And so when someone really does a good pratfall, you got to appreciate it. They just go all in and boom, and hit their head, and it's great. So, so then we're back in the act two and we're in post-op. There's a joke about a sleeping corpsman, and we see that's Goldman, and Hawkeye makes a reference to Albert Anastasia's doorman, which is referencing the hit on Albert Anastasia that took place. Unfortunately, that took place in 1957, so Hawkeye is a little ahead of the curve here.
That was like 4 years after the war, wasn't
it? Yeah, Hawkeye, whoops, okay. Well, yeah. You know, the MASH, Larry Gelbart didn't have Google to look things up in 1975. So
you have to go to the library, get the Encyclopedia Britannica out.
He's not going
to
do all that.
Anastasia. I mean, yeah, you can't do that.
Too much effort to do all that. So in the post-op, and we see that Frank obviously has degenerated quite a bit. The makeup is great. He's got these wonderful bags under his eyes and this deep red kind of thing under his eye. He looks truly sick, and he's sweaty. And the way they shoot him, his face looks kind of fuller. His chin – they always joke about it. He doesn't have any chin, but he actually has like a – you see his chin here, and he's loopy as all get out. And he's like, hi! And he has that wonderful high-pitched voice that Larry Linville was able to get into, and he begs for drops of water and stuff like that. And I love – he says, I think I've swallowed my lips, which is great. And you know, they're trying to – you know, they're trying to console him and stuff. And it leads to one of the great reveals where he lets his fellow doctors in on a big secret – that him and Margaret are dating.
Yeah. I love this. I'm going to tell you right now that this might be my favorite Larry Linville episode, period. I think that he is so good in this episode. Sick Frank is the best. The way that we learn so much about Frank in these scenes.
I mean,
about his past and just little lines like, you know, it's your time to take mother to the toilet. And it's, you know, and, I mean, little things like that. You know, he would get smacked when he got sick, or he talked about the janitor who showed him photos of heavyweight champs.
Oh, I've got to ask about that in a second, but go on. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, you learn so much about Frank and what formed Frank and why Frank became Frank Burns, and we learn it, and it's not intentional. He's just loopy, so he's just talking and saying whatever is coming to his mind, which he would never do. You know, he would never open up like this to Hawkeye and BJ and say these things to Hawkeye and BJ had he not had the fever. And I love that the writing and between the writing and Frank and Larry Linville's delivery and, like you said, the makeup and the sprayed on sweat, he looks absolutely miserable. And miserable Frank is some of the funniest Frank that I've ever seen.
Yeah, so absolutely. Oh, I couldn't agree more. And you really sort of feel sorry for him all of a sudden. You really do. He's human. You know,
yeah.
He really displayed some humanity in that monologue. And the other thing, this is actually one of my favorite moments for Loretta.
Yes.
Who had that, who the camera was sitting on her face for a long time through his monologue describing all the things in his will. And to see her go through all these things as he talked was phenomenal. I would just, she went through so many emotions. ran across her eyes and her face. It was just phenomenal. You're right. Those are two great, great, great moments from the whole season, actually.
Yeah.
They were great.
every reveal of Frank's home life as a child makes you somewhat sympathetic to why he is so awful as a person. Mm-hmm. Rizzi says, my mother used to smack me when I got sick, which is awful. Yeah. Like, when, why would you? And then she used to smack me when I got well, too. You're like, what the what is this about?
So, I know, and right?
So then there's the line about no one liked me except for the janitor, the school janitor, who used to show me pictures of his heavyweight champs. First of all, if you've ever seen The Queen's Gambit, that's how she learns how to play chess. So he should have learned to play chess instead of that. I'm going to hate to ask this question. I'm going to hate to ask it because it's kind of grim, but I can't help it because this is what has occurred to me. Is that a subtle reference that the janitor was not on the up and up? Because that's weird. That he's showing a little boy pictures of sweaty, muscly men. I feel horrible that I'm saying it, but of all that, why? Why would you show a young boy pictures of heavyweight champs?
Yeah, I mean, you could look at it on different levels.
That's the end of the show. Thanks for everybody. No. Good night.
I'm trying to keep this light, but I'm sorry.
I'm going to say you could just take it at face value that the janitor liked to collect pictures of heavyweight champs and boxers and was a big boxing fan.
And that's right.
Okay. And he's nobody liked him either. And so you have this kid and you've got these two lovable losers who don't have anybody to talk to, and they find each other and he talks to him, and this is what he shows them. It could be just taken at face value, or you could go a little deeper and a little darker and take it on a completely different road. And I'm just going to keep it over on the light side for now.
Fair enough.
Yeah, that's good. That's good.
Yeah. All
right. And I will say, I saw this episode when I was a kid, and that line never occurred. I never saw anything until I was like 9 and my dad took me to see Airplane. And there's that stuff with Peter Graves where he's asking the kid about, do you like movies about gladiators? And I was oh, okay. That's a thing. Got
now
it.
Wait,
all right.
Gladiators is a completely different thing.
Right. Well, sure. I mean, I don't know. It just seems like a very curious choice for the janitor to show a young boy that. But yeah, it could just be that he had a weird obsession. And he's one of those guys that would talk about his weird obsession, and everyone else in the school was like, what is with this guy? But here he could talk to weird, lonely Francis Burns, you know, and then they go, okay, so it's fine. So it ends with the Margaret and I are dating, and of course that reveals to, I love the look of Hawkeye. I love the look that BJ gives Hawkeye of just like, what? Like, it's like, how sick is this guy? And of course, Hawkeye doesn't burst the bubble. And, oh, okay, great. Yeah, that's wonderful. So then we get Klinger. And by the way, once again, we reveal that Klinger gets his own tent, which doesn't seem fair.
Right.
You know, he's just a corporal. Why does he get his own tent? He does. And we see that he's cheating. By the way, there was the earlier scene we saw that he broke into the office and he was stealing. So we see that he's writing the answers all over his body in ways that obviously are not going to be any help to him at all. Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, Klinger's got to cheat because he doesn't know history. And then we lead to the crowning moment of this episode, I would say. Maybe even the crowning moment of MASH, period, where we have the quiz as ministered by Hawkeye and BJ. BJ, of course, was helped crown Miss Gutterball earlier on, and that's his big claim to fame. And here we get Johnny Hamer as Sergeant Zale, and we get Radar and Klinger, and our hero, Igor Stravinsky.
Indeed.
So this scene, Jeff, I have so many questions about this scene. First of all, when you were shooting MASH, right, there had to have been alternate takes, right? Like different, like not everything was done with one take. I mean, generally, how often did things have to get redone, or did it move pretty quickly?
It moved pretty quickly. One of the things that, as I talked about, you know, once you get into the rhythm of something and the rhythm of a show, pretty much everybody knows who they are in there. And so there's not a lot of mistakes. Somebody can flub a line every once in a while, but boy, there were not a lot of takes done on one scene. They shoot a master and then they go in for the close up. So the master shot is everybody. You see all four people sitting there, and then you just cut into the close up. So you go through the whole master, and you know, if there was a mistake in the master and nobody stopped it, if Gene Reynolds didn't say cut, let's do it again, you just went on with it. And then they could change that and pick that up in a close up. So if the scene was shot and I said something stupid, I didn't say my line right, and he didn't say cut, everybody just keeps working. And then when you cut it, and then you shoot the close-ups, then my line would be, you know, properly said. So there wasn't a lot of stopping. There wasn't a lot of problems that way. Every once in a while, sure, they would say cut, let's start again. Mostly because something would happen. Somebody would drop something or something wouldn't work right or whatever. But most of the time, everybody was pretty on their game. And there weren't a lot of reshoots or you know, different scenes that you had to cut and start over. So, I wish I could say something. We had to do it 90 times. It was just horrible. But, you know, these people were good at what they did. And, it just went pretty smoothly. It really did.
I would imagine, of course, Gene Reynolds had already directed many episodes by this point. And so, I think all you guys were real familiar with your characters. I mean, Mike Farrell is the only one that really hasn't been with the show for a long period of time. Johnny Hamer had been on since season two, and you'd been on since season one. So they go through this wonderful quiz, and you're all in your dress uniform. Do you recall how long it took to shoot this whole sequence? I mean, was it like in an afternoon? I mean, I have no frame of reference for how long something like this takes.
That was probably a morning, I would think, or an afternoon. There was a lot going on. There was a lot of things happening. So that whole sequence probably took half a day to do.
Okay.
I would, if I remember correctly, and that could be incorrect, but I think that would have been pretty close to a half a day.
Gotcha. It's a marvelous scene because Hawkeye and BJ are clearly having a blast, kind of making fun, not making fun of them, but clearly Zale is as usual angry. He's just angry all the time. He's just kind of like ornery, and he's clearly not going to do it. And they know something's up with Klinger because Klinger's acting weird. Where he's doing, Hawkeye says, "If you could answer this without one of the basic ballet movements, that would be great."
Yeah,
Radar's trying at least. And then, of course, it leads to what your great line, which is where Hawkeye throws you a bone. He throws Eager a bone because you're supposed to just answer who knows it first. And then he literally turns to Igor, and of course, your answer is, "I thought there were going to be refreshments here." Which is, he's checked out. Igor's just, why is he even there?
Right, exactly. That's exactly.
I mean,
right.
Let's think about this. How the heck did the field of participants get narrowed down to these four?
Yeah.
I mean, these are the enlisted men who surpassed their colleagues in dress and deportment. I mean, no offense, Jeff, but really, these are the four?
Well, I think my hair looked good. I think that was probably
Yeah, you clean up well, Jeff. Igor cleaned up well.
Yeah.
Normally, you're seeing you in your meat-soaked, grease-soaked smock.
Exactly.
But you're looking good. Your uniform's all clean and pressed. Yeah,
you don't have a hat on in a lot of the scenes in this episode, too.
Right.
You're hatless.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. You know, one of the scenes, previous scenes in the early beginning when I came in and I saluted Hawkeye.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that? That was. I loved that when I did it. I watched it and I went, "Well, that was pretty good." I loved my body jerking when he came in and I saluted. I just loved that. I was really there. I was really worried. Well,
this is the fascinating thing about this particular episode. Because when I rewatched it, I knew in my mind that this was a Private Igor episode. Okay, because of that classic line right there. I thought there were going to be refreshments here. But
by who? Who's catering this thing?
Exactly. You. Well, Igor, you were the one in charge of the food. You should have brought some.
Yeah, why would Igor be the one doing it? It makes no sense.
Well, what fascinated me on rewatch, because I was watching this particular episode now with a more critical eye, it dawned on me that is the only line that Igor has in this entire episode. That's it.
Yeah.
And yet, in our minds, this is a landmark Igor episode. And it really – now, you're in other scenes, but you don't have a line. And it's a true testament to Jeff and Jeff's physical comedy ability, because the other scenes that he's in, he stands out by just being quiet and letting his face do all the talking.
Yeah.
I'm jumping ahead, but I am going to jump ahead later on. You return with a cigarette in your mouth,
yeah,
and you make the cigarette tremble. I've never seen anybody whose fear was shown through a cigarette, and the cigarette is so funny.
It's terrifying. That cigarette was terrifying.
It was scared to death. and yet we get it. We know everything we need to know about Igor and his trembling cigarette, and you never have to say a line. And that is kudos to you, Jeff, for pulling that off. It's quite a feat.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. Thank you very much. I didn't say the line because they didn't want to pay me more, probably. They got off cheap with a trembling cigarette.
Yeah.
It's amazing, Ryan, because I had that same thing in my notes that I when we talked about doing this, I was like, well, I want to make sure we have a big Igor episode, and it immediately went to this episode. And then I rewatched it, and I went, he just says the one line.
This feels like
a big Igor episode, and it's like,
yes.
Wait a minute, what is this? All of a sudden, it's like, he just has the one line. It's amazing. So, yeah. Great physical performance there, Jeff, because you really like you're a big part of the show, even though we have one line of dialogue. It's a killer.
A large presence, that boy.
And the way you deliver it, I mean, I'm sorry, I know I'm waxing your Jeep a little bit here, but you're here.
That's okay. Wax away.
Just the way that you say it is not like accusatory. It's sort of just hapless. I thought they were going to do that. It's just like, it's sort of like you're just so out to lunch. And I love it. I just love it. And I love Hawkeye just goes wrong. He just moves on.
Yeah, right.
Does not pause. He just moves right on to the next thing. So now we're going to get back to this melee here of the Soldier of the Month Club, because that is the title of the episode. But then there's a scene in post-op with Margaret and Frank, and it's a nice moment where poor Margaret is trying to be nice to Frank, but he's just such a baby about being sick. And, you know, he says she says, well, maybe you should get a will. And he's like, oh, I thought you said I'm okay. She says, well, look, maybe if you don't remain okay, you know, we all have to die sometime, Frank. And Frank says, you think they'd give officers a break, which is great, nonsensical. You know, somehow officers are this sort of gilded class that don't get to die or whatever.
They're immortal. Yeah.
They're immortal. It's just fantastic. poor Margaret just has to just take care of him and just baby him so badly. So, and then we get right back to the Soldier of the Month contest, and we see Radar is obviously doing very well. He's the only BJ says he's coming up on the outside, which makes no sense because that seems to suggest that Radar is behind. How can he be behind? I mean, who's answering?
The only other person who could possibly be answering more questions would be Klinger, because he has them written all over his body. Mm-hmm. There's no chance that Zale or Igor, no offense, Jeff, has gotten any of these questions correct.
Yeah. So, and then he gives the game away where he comes up with an answer to Graf, which of course leads to Hawkeye and BJ laughing, saying, that's Farragut. He said it backwards. And it, you know, it's the perfect thing, because there's a Klinger knows nothing of history that he doesn't know that to Graf is not a thing. It's just not anything, you know. And I love that Hawkeye suckers him in when he says, you can reach the high notes of the Sorcerer's Eagle batter by standing on your toes, which Klinger says, that's not part of the test. And of course, aha. How did you know? You know, and that leads to this giant fight, and there's this big squabbling where Zale wants to get involved, and he starts yelling. Now, I do have a question here, Jeff. Now, maybe again, this is, my God, 40 years ago. Maybe you don't remember. I mean, again, you're committing. You know, the reason why you're committing these things to memory. But in this scene, Radar and Klinger are fighting, and they're what we're supposed to be following, because they're yelling very loudly. Except Zale marches up to the table, and he starts getting in Hawkeye's face. And he's like, New York, New York. And he's yelling at the top of his lungs. We see that Igor has approached the table as well. And your mouth is moving. You're saying something. Now, again, I'm sorry if you don't remember this, but like when you have a scene like that, I mean, this could be for any episode, really, where you have a scene where clearly you or any other actor is supposed to be talking, but we are not supposed to hear what they're saying. It's just meant to be babble. Like, are you given direction? Is it just go up to Hawkeye and move your mouth and just pretend? Or are you saying something in your mind? I mean, how does that work as an actor? What are you supposed to do?
Okay. It was 40 years ago? Really? Oh, my God.
45.
I was actually 13 at the time, I think. Okay, well, I probably just walked up to him and just was trying to be in the moment and said something about the quiz or I'm sure I just kind of mumbled something about right. what we were doing. I mean, you get to that point and you're doing a scene like that and the camera's not right down your throat.
Right, right.
So you can kind of get away with saying pretty much anything. But I'm sure – I mean, I'm working with Alan Alda and all these folks, and Alan Alda was really a big influence on me. And so I'm going to walk up to him and be an idiot. So I probably was in the moment mm-hmm. and said something that was appropriate to a guy taking this kind of quiz and – being confused and not knowing what to do or asking, can I leave now? Or, I don't care about this. Or do I really have to stay here? Something like that would have been appropriate to my character in that moment, talking to him. That's right. probably what I said. So
I imagine that he was still on the refreshments kick. That
probably could have been. Could have been.
You're very focused on that. I would imagine that that's what it would be. And again, you're not supposed to be paying attention to that. You're supposed to be paying attention to Radar and Klinger because they're the ones with all the volume going on and they're squabbling mm-hmm. back and forth. And of course, I mean, it offends Radar probably on some fundamental level that Klinger's cheating. But aside from the fact that he might get beat by Klinger, but Radar's just scrupulously honest for the most part. Mm-hmm. And so it just bothers him that Klinger's trying to do it by cheating. And it's a very nice moment for Radar. So then we're back in post-op, and Father Mulcahy is taking the will of Father Mulcahy. And it leads to this marvelous scene, which you already talked about, Jeff, where we learn just the depths of Burns' criminality. He talks about he's got a red book and a blue book, and one of them he shows to the government, not the one. It's in a bottle of ground chuck in the fridge. He talks about his prescription kickbacks, which is just – oh man,
money buried all in the backyard.
I mean, good Lord, what a crook. And it leads again the great staging by Gene Reynolds of Margaret in the foreground as she's listening and this God. Is going on, and this is really like Margaret going through the 12 stages of grief in all in one scene. It's like she's happy and she's like, oh, it's so sweet, and then she hears about the kickbacks and she kind of like you're just like, oh my God, and it's just going on. And then she kind of goes back to it being sweet again. And then, of course, it's the kicker where, refers to Margaret and he's like, my little soldier. And he's so sweet. And it's like Margaret's at the top of the roller coaster, just before we go down. And she's expecting something so sweet. And is, I leave all my clothes.
Oh,
what? What am I supposed to do with that?
Yeah, I again, Larry Linville in this episode is brilliant, and his comic timing with that particular line was impeccable. Absolutely perfect. Dead on.
Oh, my clothes.
I love it. I love everything about the scene with Frank's will. It is probably one of my favorite scenes of the series.
And she puts her hands over her face. She's just like, mad. It's great. What am I supposed to do with your clothes, Frank? Like, what is that about? For God's sakes.
Well, it kind of goes back also to brilliant writing by, Linda Bloodworth. My gosh, holy moly. I mean, he didn't just make all those words up. Somebody wrote them for him, and he was able to deliver it, impeccably. But, man, the writing was stupendous, really stupendous.
Just to be able to have – you've got Frank and Margaret interacting. In the scene, they're interacting, but they're not because the actors are not face-to-face, and yet they're interacting. She is reacting to what Frank is saying. Frank doesn't know it, but I mean, our ire is drawn to Frank because he's the one talking, but it's Margaret, it's Loretta Swit, her face is just going through every emotion possible of like, why am I with this guy? We know Margaret is stern and she's all these things, but she's not your crook. She's she's scrupulously honest, and yet Frank is as crooked as it comes. Prescription kickbacks for the love of God. Like, what are you talking about? I mean, like, good. He's not just a bad doctor. He's a crooked doctor. I mean, he's terrible. So then we have a scene with where Radar, we see that he's won the contest and he's in his dress uniform, and Potter wishes him luck. And he says, you know, oh, we go, okay. And the brief scene, we're going to get back to that in a minute. Then we get Margaret walking Frank to the latrine where he's feeling better. I love where he's so pathetic and he says, wish me luck. And she finally has had enough. And she's like, Frank, it's only the latrine. You're not a test pilot going up.
Yeah, she brings him back down to earth.
Yeah. Oh, man, that's just great. That's absolutely marvelous. So then Hawkeye and BJ walk by and he says his temperature was back. He was normal this morning. He owes his life to you two. And then Hawkeye, I don't know if we can live with that, which is, this is great. And then we're back to the Potter and Radar, where they talk about you're going to make sure a young man should know how to protect himself, which of course Potter is referring to something a little more on the salacious side. Radar takes it literally, saying that he knows karate. And even does a karate chop. A scene, by the way, always cut in syndication. I never saw that scene until I got the DVDs.
And earlier, there in the scene with Potter and Radar, Potter asks Radar about his toothbrush. And he says, well, I'm going to get a new one. I broke mine last month. You haven't brushed your teeth in a month, Radar?
That's rough. Oh. That is rough.
Forget the rats. That's even more disgusting.
Yeah, that is bad stuff. So now we're outside the latrine. Obviously, Frank's been there a while. There's a great bit of physical comedy where waiting for them all, Hawkeye, BJ, and Margaret start walking, pacing back and forth, and they are all timed perfectly so they are not bumping into one another. Margaret is walking from camera right to camera left. BJ is going from the foreground to the background. Hawkeye's doing the reverse. And I'm sure it was done in other movies, but it's the scene that it makes me think about is the scene in Singing in the Rain, where there's a scene where with Gene Kelly and Donald O'Connor and the actor that played the movie studio chief, I'm forgetting his name, where they are pacing, and it's the three of them going crisscross, crisscross, crisscross as they're waiting, and their heads are down, and it's just a great bit of physical comedy from the actors and from Gene Reynolds, who I assume is the one that staged it.
So good.
Yeah, it's really, really funny. So then they bother Frank about, and then he finally says, can a guy get a little private? And then he comes out, and here is our poor Igor once again, as he walks by with the cigarette, and he's, you know, and it's a reminder of how loose the 4077 is, that Igor can walk by 3 to 4 officers, and he does not salute them. He takes no notice of them, because that's the way it is, the 4-7.
Well, and the contest is over, too. He doesn't have to.
He doesn't care anymore.
I don't give a damn.
Exactly. Lost. And you've got Larry Linville with some great volume, where he goes, hey! And he screams, and he stands there, and again, there's the quaking cigarette. A great bit of – and you even do a little gulp. Like, you see your Adam's apple go down. It's like, gulp? It's – great bit of physical comedy. Was this shot the same day as the Soldier of the Month contest, or was this a different day, if you can remember?
I can't remember. I couldn't tell you that. I don't know. I don't think so, but I couldn't tell you. They were shot – the episodes took 3 days to shoot, and then they would have to come back and do a reshoot. But everything was shot in 3 days.
Amazing.
So you had a – Monday you'd have a rehearsal day. Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday you'd shoot. Friday you'd have a rehearsal day. Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, you'd shoot, and that was what it was. And then they go back after three or four shows. They go back and they pick up shots that they had to fix or do whatever. But that it took 3 days to shoot an episode.
Amazing!
So,
amazing.
Yeah, I wish I could tell you. I don't know whether that was the same day or not.
So, so then if you poor Igor, you know, has to put out his, you know, and Frank says field strip it, and you know, police the area, and Frank and Igor runs off, and then that's the conclusion. He's better. And that leads to Margaret taking him behind the tent. And I love when she says, can you walk this way with me, Major? And both Hawkeye and BJ are like, what's going on here? And that's what she does. The whole bit about, if you're going to give away your clothes, give them to somebody your own size. And she slaps him upside the head, drops him to the compound, leads BJ and Hawkeye to rescue him. And I love that they're kind of feeling bad for him. And they treat him like he's a buddy.
Yeah.
And they're like, come on with us, Frank. And even Frank even says, I almost died, you know. And Hawkeye says, well, we did our best, Frank. Love that line. Great button on the episode. It's just fantastic. Yeah. So, and that's the end of our act break. And then we come back with just a little button scene where we find out that Frank has, of course, already been rat-thinking on other people in the camp. So we see that he's better. Mm-hmm. And then the MP delivers a very drunk and dirty radar. Unfortunately, this MP is uncredited, even though he gets a couple of lines. I was not able to find who this actor is, which is very strange. Usually, if you get even a single line, you get credited. But on IMDb, he's not listed. He lists the charges. Gary Berghoff.
He even gets a name, Leonard.
Yeah, Raider Leonard. I love that he got to know the MP during this time on a first name basis, and he even says, "Say hello to your wife," which feels even like a slightly salacious that he's saying something he shouldn't be saying. Berghoff always did a great drunk when he's Radar is drunk, and I love that he even refers to Colonel Potter as Sherm at one point. Which is totally verboten. You cannot do that.
Yeah. Well, two things about this scene. One is this scene is also cut from syndicated versions because I had never seen this scene either until I got the DVDs. At one point, Potter says to Radar, "You've never been drunk before." But he has been drunk before in Abyssinia Henry. He was drunk. And then he'll be drunk again in the very next episode in The Gun.
That's right.
And I know that I think that there were other times that he was drunk too. But those two stood out in my mind.
He gets drunk Colonel Penobscot's bachelor party.
That's right. That's right. So I guess I can see though Potter has never seen Radar drunk.
Right.
Henry and Hawkeye and Trapper were with him when he was drunk with Henry. But I guess this might be the first time that Potter has seen drunk Radar, and I agree with you. Aside from Loretta Swit, Gary Berghoff is my favorite MASH drunk.
It's just so you're so not used to seeing Radar like that. And the final moment, I always say some of these scenes feel ad-libbed, but I know that from reading up on MASH that it was, you know, you did not ad-lib, but you followed the script. And why would you not? When you're getting scripts this good, you're not going to go off the page. But the way this episode ends, where Radar tries to wink at Colonel Potter, and he even goes, "This eye can't even wink." And the way that Alan Alda and Mike Farrell start to laugh, it feels like Berghoff just thought of that. It's probably not true, but man, it has that loose, drunky energy, and it's just a perfect way to wrap the scene up because you buy it that Radar is just totally sloshed.
Yeah.
One of the, you know, you watching that and. It is amazing. There was real brilliance there, and there were some of them all, you know, weren't all brilliant, but there are moments of brilliance like that that you just go, "Wow, this is a real treat to see this," and to watch what they did and the way they did it. And there's a little tight scene, and you're crammed around a little desk. This thing is maybe 8x8. You know, you're standing, and there's 50 people, and there's a camera, and there's lights and things, and yet. That was an intimate moment of these guys having this kind of guy moment and this drunk guy and their pal and going through this and appreciating it. And you really were there. You really believed it. And even when I would stand and watch, if I was standing watching a scene like that, you were there. They were there, which is some of the brilliance of the actors of MASH. They were always present. They were always in the moment. They loved those characters, and they, you know, they really did the best they could to do them and present them every given second when they were being shot. So that's the brilliance and the wonder of MASH, at least from my perspective.
Yeah.
I know.
Yeah, right, yeah. I mean, but that's what I've been talking about, is that even an episode like this, which is not high stakes, it doesn't feature any guest characters. It doesn't really change the show in any great way. It doesn't feature some sort of weighty issue like, you know, religion or, you know, a lost love of Hawkeye or the interview. Yes, but yet it's still that funny. It's that consistently good when it's an episode that's just about, like, you know, a medical case and Frank gets sick.
Yeah, that's true. But they did touch on death. I found that suddenly I went, there's somebody's briefly talking about being dead. and I, you know, Frank dying or, you know, making a will is a pretty serious thing.
Hmm.
And it fluttered over death, I think. And it also fluttered over Margaret's strength as a woman and her ability to fight back against somebody that was really treating her badly. and to do it not only, you know, emotionally, but she did it physically. I mean, that was a very huge statement for her to make, to slug this guy after having this, you know, this relationship. And she was making a huge statement. And I bet that that was a conversation between her and the writer. I think she wanted to grow in the show, to be able to make those kinds of statements as a woman who was, why would she accept going with a guy like that who was that terrible? So this was a moment in time where she whacked him in the face and really presented that truth for her and everybody to see, I believe.
Yeah, you have to assume that this was – they were layering this in to split them up in season five, is that more and more she's just not on board with how awful he is. She's right. Again, he's so crooked. He's just so crooked.
Yeah.
It's one thing to be, kind of dumb. It's another thing to be corrupt. And he's just – obviously he's been – and also we didn't just, mention he's obviously got a woman on the side. He's got his secretary.
That's
right.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Did she ever slug Frank Burns at all throughout the entire other
episode? Yes, she does in the episode where she gets engaged, where he tries to put the moves on her. She starts hitting him. And he even says, no fair, Margaret, no hitting. I think she throws stuff at him. I think this might be the only one where she literally belts him.
Yeah, this is the only episode. I mean, you guys know a lot more about show than I do, but believe me, but this is the only time I've seen her haul off and slug him to knock him down or knock him out.
Yeah,
that was a serious slug. Mm-hmm. And that was a big statement for her to make. This wasn't a cute little, slap around and silly stuff. That was a real deal. She hauled back and whacked him.
Yeah.
She really did.
Absolutely marvelous. So yeah, it's a great episode. It continues the quality of season four. It's just every show is funny, unique. It's a heavily medical show, which hadn't really been done a whole lot to that point. Later on in later seasons, they would focus more on specific illnesses. But here it's kind of like, all right, we're going to take a real thing and talk about Korean hemorrhagic fever and weave it into the show.
And that's great. Interesting. We're talking about a disease that they didn't know how to combat.
Yeah.
And just gosh, what are we doing today? They had that same problem.
It's just an absolutely great episode. So, all right. So guys, as we're wrapping up here, I have to ask both of you, do you have a particular favorite line or joke? I mean, look, I think all of us would probably say I thought there were going to be refreshments here. Is the clear winner, but I'm gonna select an alt because I feel like that's obviously the best line. But I do want to highlight some other ones. So, do you guys have a particular favorite line or joke from this episode? So, Ryan, why don't you go first?
Well, there were a lot of great lines in this episode. So this was hard for me. I will tell you that Margaret and I are dating is a line that gets me every single time, but. There's another line in this episode that really goes unnoticed, and I love these kinds of lines. MASH was great, and of course, Larry Gelbart especially, was great at writing these little zingers, these little subtle lines that, unless you're paying attention, will go way over your head. But early in the episode, in the post-op, Radar comes in and says, "Sir, Hawkeye?" And Hawkeye replies by saying, "Thanks for the knighthood, Radar." And that line, I remember the first time that line finally got through to me, and I laughed so hard. And to this day, it's one of the lines that gets me because I don't see it coming. And it catches me by surprise almost every time that I watch this episode. And so that I'm picking that as my favorite line from the episode.
I love that Radar doesn't understand when Hawkeye says, "Thanks for the knighthood," and Radar's like, "What?" He doesn't get it.
Yeah.
It's a great moment. So, Jeff, do you have a particular line outside of your one line as Eagle?
I don't think so. I have to remain true to myself and to my brilliance there at this, in the show and stick with, "I thought there were going to be refreshments here." I can't get any better. I don't think a line gets any better than that.
How did Linda Bloodworth not win the Emmy for that line alone?
Really?
I don't understand.
Gosh, darn.
What other garbage was on television that beat that line? I don't understand. What are they talking about? So fair enough. Fair enough. I knew that was kind of a gimme. How could it not be your favorite line when you're the one who said it for Pete?
That's true. I do want to say thank you for the kind things you said about me and my performance. I really appreciate those kind words. I really do. After 40 or 50 years, it's really fun for me and enjoyable. And Ryan and I talk about this on our podcast that, I didn't know all this stuff was going on when I did the show. I didn't know all this emotional connection to the characters and to the show was happening, because I was just a wacky cookie guy trying to do a job and keep working and be an actor and have fun and do stuff. So this is a real treat. It's a real treat to talk to you and hear your analysis of the show and have this conversation with you. And certainly have you wax poetically about me. I certainly appreciate that.
Oh, absolutely. It's a joy. Thank you guys. I will do my favorite line and then we're going to wrap it. But my favorite line actually is right after Margaret slaps Frank and they come rescue him. And he says, "What happened?" And she says, "She hit me right in the chin." And BJ says, "How'd she find it?" Chef's kiss. Just marvelous. Yes. Absolutely. They're making fun of poor Frank and Larry Linville to a certain extent by talking about he doesn't have a chin. BJ is just so great. So anyway, so guys, thank you so much for doing this. I've been looking forward to this for so long. I really love your show. It's just one great episode after the next. And so I feel very honored that I got to be on your show and then you got to come over to my humble effort and do this. This was just marvelous. So thank you both for doing this.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having us. We really, I love MASHcast. I love listening to it. I think it is a really good, I think that both of our podcasts together work really well hand in hand. MASH Matters, we kind of focus on the big picture and really just look at the MASH and do an oral history of MASH and talk about why MASH mattered then and why it matters now. And then you take that and you're able to go episode by episode and discuss the minutia of every episode. But it's all important and it all makes up the everything, your podcast, the little bits of things that you discover and talk about in your podcast and what we talk about in our podcast complement one another and make up the whole picture, which is that MASH is still as relevant today as it was, when it premiered almost 50 years ago.
Yeah, absolutely. It's true. And I really enjoyed listening to your analysis of the show and finding those little details that I certainly didn't do. I know Ryan does it a lot better than I do, but hearing him, it was very pleasant. So I thank you. And again, thank you for certainly having us on the show. It was pleasant. And hey, you have to come back on MASH Matters sometime.
Absolutely.
And have some fun. Yeah,
absolutely. So I guarantee there is no way that anyone listening to this doesn't know about where your show is, but just in case, let's end with a plug. Ryan, where can people find MASH Matters?
You can find us on we have a website, mashmatters.com. You can also find us on just about any podcast player. And we're on Twitter, we're on Facebook, and we're also now on Instagram too. So just search for MASH Matters and you should probably be able to find us.
Very cool. Very cool. Of course. And again, any, all of you that listening to this, listen to MASH Matters already. So I'm going to have to tell you to go over to listen to the show. You already do. So again, thanks so much guys for doing this. I really appreciate it. Of course, if you want to find this show, all the back episodes, go to our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, and Amazon Music. We're always talking MASH over on Twitter at MASH477Cast. And then finally, if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, you go to patreon.com/FW podcast. There you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So a big salute to Nicholas Prom, Russell Burbage, Stan Peel, Dolph DeVries, Bert Schramm, Mike Thomas, Michael Porter, and Danny Ulrich for their support of MASHcast. I really do appreciate it, guys. So that's going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will see you next week. But until then, I thought there were going to be refreshments here.
Come here and watch now while I unleash me invention, Nazi Fagin spicy coated peanuts. Okay, beautiful, there you go. They're called Nutsy Fagan Spicy Coated Peanuts because I'm Nutsy Fagan, and they're peanuts covered with a crunchy, spicy coat.
Stevie's handing out samples of the barbecue flavor now.
They love them. Nutsy Fagan Spicy Coated Peanuts. Just peanuts. They ain't.
Sergeant Zale, many of the settlers who came to California in 1848 were searching for what?
Palm trees. How the hell do I know? I'm from Brooklyn.
Igor.
I thought there were going to be refreshments here.